The committee meeting for the Natural Resource Subcommittee of Joint Ways and Means, and we're going to temporarily open the public hearing for Senate Bill 5527, Division of State Lands. But when we get a quorum, I will recess this hearing and go into a work session. So, Sue, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, the division is here to continue the agency presentation, and then we'd like to also have the Budget and Management Division overview of the division's 2005 budget.
You want to finish the hearing first in the department?
That's correct.
Okay. Pam, go ahead.
I'm going to start with performance measures. The first measure to talk about is the Common School Fund.
I'm sorry.
Page 23 of the PowerPoint presentation. Did you get any
information? That's section 3.
That would have been under tab 1, the PowerPoint presentation.
Page 23?
Page
23,
that's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, Director of the Division of State Lands. I'm going to review a number of performance measures that we've developed during this biennium for the Division of State Lands. They were reviewed by the Progress Board. They said that we have good databases, but some of the what we hope to achieve in the years ahead may be a bit optimistic. Since this is the first set of performance measures that we've put together, we're still establishing the baseline, so in some cases we would not have the information available for you yet, but we will be compiling them in the years ahead. The first one has to do with the Common School Fund, trying to achieve over $1 billion by 2000 with annual increase in revenues of 4.5%. Another measure will be the percentage of unclaimed property holders who remit annually, with the 2005 target being 50%. Right now we're at about 33%. Another measure is the percentage of users of DSL lands and waterways who pay appropriate fees. The 2005 target is 75%. We estimate that we think the current level is about 50%.
Mr. Chair, if you go back, Director Hannes, if you wouldn't mind. I'm just trying to understand how you arrived at some of those things and what makes you think that you can achieve them. What things are within your control? What are the methodologies within your control to allow some of this stuff to happen? Why did you pick a billion? Why not 900 million? I'm just trying to get a sense of the rationale behind the numbers. The target is up from 50%, from 33% to 50. What things under those measures do you have in your ability to control?
Senator Mesley, Representative Johnson, the goal of being greater than a billion is at least to give us a target to achieve, hopefully in the next 7 to 10 years. In terms of what we can achieve, we will be continuing to pursue waterway leases, for example, other opportunities for state grants, working with the Fishermen's Underground Cable Committee for additional easements to grant for cables coming into the state, working with the Department of Forestry on timber revenues to increase that in the years ahead. So I think there's a variety of things that we can do. Another area is that we have pretty low compliance right now for unclaimed property remitters, and we believe that we can bump that up by increasing awareness, having better outreach, doing the audits that we're currently engaged in.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Hello.
When you went through laying out these performance measures, some of the things that you've just talked about have concomitant costs. When you prepared this, did you try to anticipate the cost? I'm thinking, for example, increasing sales off timberlands, costs for litigation, costs for appeals. bringing users of waterways into fee compliance, rural development, legal fees. I'm just trying to get a sense of the level of analysis that went into developing your performance measures and whether or not you went down to that level of detail.
Senator Meserly, Representative Johnson, when we were looking at this, the 4.5% over a year represents only revenues. However, when we projected out looking at 7 to 10 years, we did factor in both what our projected expenses would be on the current, based on the current budget that we have, and looking at the expected revenues that we would get. So looking at that, we think we could get there, and also if we start achieving some of the investment gains and the market turns around some.
One last point. The point that I'm trying to make is that these are new performance measures, and you are now laying down an expectation for the agency. You've said you've been through a pretty rigorous process. You've had stakeholder input. You've taken the plan out, if I recall the testimony correctly.
Senator Meserly, Representative Johnson, in terms of our strategic plan, we've not yet taken that out to the public for comment. However, we have had extensive comment on our asset management plan when that asset management plan was adopted in the early or in the mid-1990s, and that asset management plan lays out basically the strategy for managing land and benefiting the common school fund.
If you don't mind, Ann, I'd like to recess your hearing. So we'll recess the hearing for Senate Bill 5527 and open the work session for the request from the Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Siebert.
Mr. Chair, you have before you a request for retroactive approval for the submission of a federal grant application to the Environmental Protection Agency for $400,000 to conduct brownfield site assessments. And I believe Dick Peterson of the Department of Environmental Quality is here to briefly go over the grant application and answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the Land Quality Division Administrator for the Department of Environmental Quality. And as was pointed out, I'm here to request your approval to apply for a $400,000 grant from the EPA for brownfield assessment. Real quickly, brownfields are sites that are either have real or perceived contamination, and that contamination on that property is preventing, is a barrier to redevelopment for reuse. Doing this kinds of cleanups and assessment is a priority for DEQ and EPA. In developing our application, we worked across the state with local governments to identify sites that we could apply this money to, and we targeted mostly rural and economically distressed communities that have properties that are not being redeveloped because of this barrier. This money will allow us to do assessments of those properties, which really allows us to fully understand the extent of contamination and present options for cleanup so that it can be the barrier for redevelopment can be removed. We had extensive public involvement for this, working with communities, letting citizens know what our intent was, and what boiled out of that is this $400,000 grant application. Well, right now we're looking at 8 underground storage tank sites across the state that are contaminated, need some work, or potentially contaminated, need some work, and 4 hazardous waste sites. And so that's it, and so we're asking for your approval for this grant request. If you have any questions, I'd certainly be happy to answer them.
You have one. I see that the application was due March 19th. Why do we have an after-the-fact request?
Mr. Chair, I think on March 7th we forwarded a letter letting you know we were going to apply for the application, and that was submitted to meet an EPA deadline, and so then we're back here to ask for your retroactive approval.
Also, Mr. Chair, if I might clarify a bit, when they were considering this grant, I believe the subcommittee was beginning to deal with Special Session 6 and also did not have any rules under which that they could go to work session.
That was a definite interference.
If I could. The Ways and Means Committee and or Emergency Board, depending upon when it was, from time to time has made a really big issue out of this. This is a great cause, and I don't mean to cause any difficulty with it, but some tells me that you've made the decision to apply for the grant prior to a day or two before you submitted it, and so giving us 12 days notice, even if we had had rules, would have made it difficult for us to get it through the process and to the full committee. And it's just a matter of, it's hard to deal with them after the fact, and it's awkward for everybody if we were to decide we didn't like it, to say no you can't after you've already applied. So it's just nice to let us know where you're headed ahead of time.
And I guess, Senator, from the explanation we've heard, we are to blame for some of that ourselves.
I mean, no, I think what he was saying was that had we gotten it, we couldn't have acted on it, and I agree with that. But the fact that they didn't even try to get it to us still concerns me, and I wouldn't want that the next one, while we do have rules, then comes in that late as well, so that we regularly end up with agencies thinking that retroactive is okay. Because one of these days we're going to hit one we don't like. We've done that before. And then you have to tell them, well, go tell your federal folks you didn't really mean that application. And that's really awkward.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, if I could just for a minute, I have let the agency know that since the assembly is in session that we would probably not be hearing any more retroactive grant applications at this point.
Okay. Mr. Siebert, do we know when the agency received the application?
Did the EPA receive the application?
No, when DEQ got this application?
Was made aware of the grant? I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I don't know the exact date, and I can find out for you. EPA, this is a new development within EPA in terms of providing money out for brownfields development. So I think as far back as late last year, we knew that EPA was planning to provide money, and EPA was really working on what were the criteria, all those sorts of things. So it wasn't necessarily a firm date. There was a lot of, this is a new grant from EPA, and so there's a lot of uncertainty about what a grant application would look like. But we did know that the potential for this kind of money was available because EPA was changing their funding scheme for brownfields late last year.
When do we know the date when DEQ received the application for this program and started considering applying for the grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I don't know that date exactly. If we have one, I could find out.
That would be, I think, very helpful, because I think that's really the point that you're trying to get to.
Well, colleagues, the message that we want to make very strong and put on the record is that we will look very unkindly, at least while we're in session, and I would assume in the interim the e-board will have the same philosophy of after-the-fact applications. So,
Mr. Chair, are you looking for a motion?
I think so.
We're in work session. Are you in
work
session?
We are in work session.
I would move the... well, we haven't had... Have we had...
We actually need to hear from Lisa and Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are in a hurry.
Just trying to keep things moving along.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that the subcommittee approve the request.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Legislative Fiscal also recommends approval of the request.
And, Mr. Chair, I move that we accept LFO's recommendation and move this request to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
You heard the motion. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion passes. And Representative Krager, would you like to carry the bill? Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session and reopen the public hearing for Senate Bill 5527.
And can I ask a question?
Representative Morgan.
With reference to the goal being to increase the revenue to the common school fund by 4.5%, I just ran some quick and dirty numbers on this sheet that you gave us yesterday, and by my calculations, the 01 revenues were just shy of $20 million.
and the O2 revenues were just over $16.5 million, meaning that there's about a 17% drop from the O1 biennium to the O2 biennium in the revenue coming into the Common School Fund. And the bulk of it is forest harvest. And so I'm really questioning, given that we're going to see another decrease in that, whether this is a realistic goal, given the weight that the forest harvest has in the total revenue stream.
Senator Mesley, Representative Morgan, it may be. What we were hoping is that 4.5% would be an average over time, and we will likely have major fluctuations from year to year with it. But in the next year or two, until we get a habitat conservation plan in place, we're going to see probably continued revenues from the from forestry being down.
And, you know, just looking over time on the harvest revenue numbers here, from about 1999 until the present time, there's been a steep decline in the harvest revenues. And I think it just is a point that's worth making, that it really doesn't make that much difference what you do in the other revenue streams if that one's falling off.
So, Nesley, Representative Morgan, that's certainly a large part of it, although I think whatever we can do in the other revenue sources, we will try to do to try to boost and maintain revenues for the Common School Fund.
I want to tag on to this and make this statement for the record, I guess, that between now and when we do our work session, I think we need to sit down and have some pretty serious talks about the cost of some of these revenues as well, and whether we're efficiently, we're doing all we can to, and this comes back to my issue of process too, but the fill and removal was a big flag to me yesterday, as well as some of the other categories that for the money we get, some of these costs are pretty extensive. So we'll look forward to having those discussions with the department. Senator Dukes?
Mr. Chair, under what rules does State Forestry manage the Common School Fund lands? Are they managed under the Forest Practices Act or forestry's new management plan?
Senator Mesley, Senator Dukes, they are managed in accordance with the plan for the Common School Fund. Now, there's you may be thinking of the Northwest Forest Plan, but that governs primarily most of the county lands, county trust lands in Clatsop, Tillamook counties, although there are a few scattered tracts of Common School Fund lands there. So that plan would govern for those Common School Fund lands in that area, but they're fairly limited. The largest bulk of our lands is in the Elliott State Forest, and that's governed by its own plan, which is approved by the State Land Board.
Is there such a thing as a summary? I'd love to, not in detail, but I'd love to see the summary of how we actually manage those lands.
Senator Mesley, Senator Dukes, what I can do is have the Department of Forestry pay a visit to you, or next week when you have them come to their budget hearing, that might be a good topic to ask.
Okay, just give them a call. I'm going out with them tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow afternoon out in the district, so you can... we could talk about it then.
That would be
fine. If they knew in advance, so they could be prepared to do that.
Representative Krieger.
Just real quickly, Chair Mesley.
And the volume coming off those lands has decreased, and that's been compounded by the downsizing or the downgrade of the value of timber by board feet. Isn't that right? I mean, those were probably two of the contributing causes of the 17% you're talking about.
Senator Mesley.
Got two things working on it.
Senator Mesley, Representative Krieger, that's correct. It's primarily the drop in the stumpage prices, as well as projected drop in volume, at least for the next biennium.
Okay. Colleagues, We've got a lot of material to get through today, and this is our last day of the division, so let's try to hold our questions down unless it's for clarification on the presentation that we're not going to make it. So go ahead, Ann.
Thank you. The next performance measure deals with having area management plans in place for state-owned lands. Also under here is the percentage of state lands and waterways with completed resource inventories and lands and waterways with completed area management plans. Goal 3 deals with maintaining and restoring wetlands. Under that is the annual gain and loss of freshwater wetlands. This is based on the current level rather than going back in time, looking at how wetlands were at the time of, say, for example, settlement. And is also based on data that's collected with regard from our removal fill permit information. Another measure connected with this is looking at estuarine wetlands. And then the last item in here for wetlands on this slide is the percentage removal fill violations resolved.
And let me just, in relation to the wetlands, how do you tabulate the amount of wetlands that that is now reverted back to a wetland? And what I'm getting at is that I believe there's been a lot of wetlands that the landowners have just seemed to let it go. But it probably wouldn't show up on your records because it wasn't through any kind of a government program or mitigation or anything else. And I'm always concerned that do we have valid data? For instance, in my district, I know of several ranches that a landowner just gave up back. And do you know whether that reaches your database or not?
Senator Messerly, I've asked to be here today Janet Moreland, who's the expert in our wetland program, and she has been the one that has worked on the state of the environment report and could address your question.
If you'd like to pull up another chair, that'd be great.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Janet Moreland. I'm the Wetlands Program Manager with the Division of State Lands, and I've been working on the benchmark with the Oregon Progress Board for a number of years. Mr. Chair, in answer to your question, this particular benchmark is aimed at what we as an agency have some control over, and primarily annual data, so we do rely heavily on our permit database. What we have done to try to capture those voluntary or kind of accidental restorations that you speak of is to initiate a study on the coast with federal funding to look at the wetland change over a period of time, and that will provide us with more updated maps and a pretty good estimate of what's actually happening out there regardless of the permit database.
This same scenario happening throughout the state in the Willamette Valley, at least in Western Oregon. My guess is that there's the economy for agriculture is really very poor right now, that there's other properties that they're letting go back to without any harvest or any management.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is happening probably to a much lesser extent than on the coast because there's a number of dikes, for example, dike pastures that have just been let go as farmers retire and their families are off doing other things. We have done a study in the Willamette Valley, which looked at actual wetland change between 1982 and 1994, and that did give us some data for that 10-year time period.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on here, with regard to maintaining and restoring wetlands, is the percentage of required cities with approved and adopted local wetland inventories, as well as the rate of full compliance with removal fill permit conditions. The last one in terms of our performance measure has to do with a high level of public support. This is one where we're going to be working on in the future because we're going to be instituting doing some other types of surveys, and we're going to have to work on looking at how we compile the information, but this was a rough estimate about where we are right now. I'm going to move quickly through the next couple slides because...
Mr. Chair, might I make a comment on these performance measures?
Senator Morgan.
I think that I've made the same comment in previous budgets that we've heard. And what I see here are performance measures that track environment issues related to environmental quality, basically. But I don't see the other part of the sustainability equation, the ability of doing this while protecting the economic and the social issues that are involved in it, too. And I'm wondering, again, just to introduce into the discussion, the fact that we aren't going to be successful in Oregon if we're only rating success by the environmental scorecard, that there's an economic piece and that there's a social values piece to this that isn't being measured here at all.
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, that's one of the reasons why, in addition to having the benchmark for wetlands, we also have the one for common school fund. But are you asking with regard specifically to the wetlands program?
I'm just making a comment with relation to how you're measuring success as your performance measures. That I don't know that the income into the Common School Trust Fund is a good measurement of how you are balancing the environmental considerations that the agency has with the social and economic considerations in terms of the well-being of the state of Oregon and what the benchmark should be, because I don't believe that the state of Oregon is going to be successful and move towards a place that's reasonable to be if we're only measuring success by how much wetland we have or, you know, how many fees people are paying. That there's other aspects of this, too, that I think aren't reflected in those performance measures, and that's how your performance measures can help maintain a viable economy in the state and protect the social structures that are in place.
Senator Misery, Representative Morgan, what we can try to do in duly noting your concerns, we'll be working with Jeff Tryons of the Progress Board and trying to refine these and look at any other performance measures that we can have, and we can see if he's got some ideas for ones that might best reflect that too.
Well, and I think as we go into work session, Mr. Chair, that these are issues that need to be addressed, that we have to have, I think, measurements of success that truly are success.
I think Rep. Jenny makes a good point, and I was going to bring this up too. And that there's a whole other side to this as to what is the cost of mitigation, because I believe that the easy mitigation is being used up at an alarming rate, and that mitigation is going to become more and more expensive as we go through and try to recover our economy. So the cost of mitigation, I would think, would be one measurement. But I'm also very interested in the impact this has on economic development. And as it raises the cost of economic development, I know what it's doing to not only in delays, but also in the cost of building our transportation system, as an example, particularly on the coast, but I think all over the state. And some of these kind of measurements, I think, would be extremely valuable to us. And if we could get something put together before we go to work session, I would appreciate that. I'm also, and we've talked about this, very interested in other goals and priorities and performance measurements beyond just the progress board. As to service, as to measurements of just how the department is functioning and fulfilling their missions. And I would hope that although the mission speaks mostly to the Common School Fund and protecting resources, but I think the department has a very strong role in economic development in the state. And I don't see that reflected. But how you can fulfill the moving forward and progressing. And I think it's very urgent, quite frankly, in this state that we don't have time to sit around for 2 years or more beyond developing these kind of goals and measurements. I think we need to be on it immediately, as soon as possible.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Morgan.
I think the concept that you introduced about having some kind of measurement of the cost per acre or the cost per project or something would be real interesting. And what I'm considering there is, for example, you've got a performance measure that relates to the amount of wetlands, I believe, or loss of wetlands, and I think that it would be interesting to try to develop a performance measure that charted the cost per acre of reclaiming wetlands, because I think a most successful program would be being able to reclaim wetlands for the lowest possible amount of money, and that you get to a point where you have to ask yourself if you're paying thousands and thousands of dollars per acre to restore wetlands, whether you couldn't be making better use of that money, putting it into something else.
Thank you. It's my perception as well that as the supply of mitigation potentials becomes more scarce, that the value of those mitigations is going to increase. I guess that's kind of what we're saying. And I think we should be at the point now where we can measure just by sales and just by purchases exactly what is happening to the to that cost.
Senator Messley, we'll take a look at that. Many times it is very dependent upon the individual project and what's required, because often the mitigation can be done on site or just by the location of the of where the project will be. So we can see what type of measurements might be possible and try to report back to the committee.
One more very brief question, Ed. How does the division set the multiple of how much land needs to be mitigated for an acre or whatever size the wetland that's being developed? Is that a
standard? Steve Purchase to come and talk about mitigation, or maybe John Lilly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Lilly, the Assistant Director for Division of State Lands. Recently, the division completed a rulemaking process that looked at what we call compensatory wetland mitigation, and you've had a little bit of discussion about that. The ratios are set an administrative rule based upon public comment and input. And the ratio, the principle of ratios is, and it's really, it's based upon the concept of how one chooses to do their mitigation. So in part, it's dependent upon the applicant and what they decide to do. If they're impacting an acre of wetland, then they can choose from three different choices in how they might conduct their mitigation. If you just give me a moment, let me refresh my memory as to the ratios themselves. The ratios are set basically for a couple of reasons. One, to make sure that we offset the temporary loss of wetland functions while the mitigation is coming up to full function. Second is to compensate for the likelihood of success from different mitigation techniques. And those techniques are creation, restoration, and enhancement. So creation would be taking a piece of property that was not a wetland when they started and artificially creating a wetland there, trying to mimic what nature would do. Oftentimes that means that you're going to do a lot of grading. You're going to have to somehow move water through some natural cycle into the property, and then do planting of wetland-type plants in order to get them established. Enhancement would be taking an existing wetland that may be of low quality. Say the soil condition is such that it would be a wetland. There are some water conditions available to make it a wetland, but there may be a lack of wetland plants. And so an enhancement might be to control some invasive plants and to plant some other wetland plants in order to get a more functional, higher functioning wetland. And then finally, restoration might be taking a property that had been wetland once before. Say it had wetland soils, but lacked water. For some reason, had been drained. And restoring the water to the site so that, once again, that property could be able to function as a wetland. So you can see that you have different techniques that you've used to restore or enhance or create a wetland, and you're trying to offset the impacts that are happening to the property that where the development is occurring. So these ratios come into account when you're using one of these techniques. So for restoration, the ratio is 1 acre of restored wetland for 1 acre of impacted wetland. For enhancement, that's the one where you're taking existing wetland and you're making it better. That's 3 acres of enhanced wetland for 1 acre of impacted wetland. For creation, it's 1.5 acres of wetland created for 1 acre of wetland impact. And again, it's driven by the choice of the applicant as to how they want to go about providing for the mitigation.
John, what scientific basis did the department use to develop those ratios?
They were originally based upon research done with what other states have used, and sitting the original ratios were set up on the basis of a committee that was established back in the early 90s and included representatives from the academic community and consultants and other agencies. And during our rulemaking process, there was that we recently went through, there were comments about the idea of making the ratios go to a one-to-one basis, 1 acre of impact to 1 acre of creation, restoration, enhancement. And we did consider that, and we seriously considered it. And I think there's some folks in the community that think that that's maybe a fairer approach. But when you look at trying to balance the public policy matters of trying to compensate for the impact and restore or provide for the same function of the wetland that you're impacting, you need these techniques of enhancement, restoration, and creation to be based upon doing a bit more than what you're impacting. What we would hope in the future, and what we're working towards now, is a system of judgment that would allow to us to get back closer to a one-to-one type of relationship based upon really understanding what the functions of the impacted wetland are, so that when someone is doing mitigation, they're looking at replacing the function, water storage, sediment trapping, wildlife habitat, whatever, that is actually being impacted. When you do that, then you're likely going to be more in an even exchange. But the state of the science is not there quite yet to allow us to do assessments at that level. And in fact, there's a bill that's being worked on in the House with the wetland work group that is going to be recommending that the agency develop that methodology over the next year and then implement that.
Appreciate that. I do want to move along, but could you supply us with some of the information from other states that were used to develop the measures?
I'm going to move quickly through these slides so we can get through. We talked about fee changes and expenditures and factors driving costs. So I'm going to start with the Common School Fund Enhancement Program packages. The first one, 101, and this is page 29 of the PowerPoint presentation. This continues as a limited duration position, that was granted by the legislature in the last session, a waterway leasing position, as well as a rangeland position. This is for $291,203. Talk about the waterway position first. The specific goals that we would have for this would be to inspect 10% of leases with a target of 75% compliance, review 5 sales for 5 parcels for sale and 100 dock registrations. What we achieved in the in this biennium with this position, looking at year-to-date revenues compared to the same period in the prior biennium, our revenues are up by about $700,000, or up 29%. Our waterway lease revenues up 20%, and grazing revenues up 5%.
And when you put these goals, is that per year, or what are we talking?
These are biennial goals.
Senator Duke.
75% compliance after all these years of having leasings doesn't seem very high.
I'm asking Steve Purchase to come up and talk about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations. With our staff that we have, the 4 folks we have that basically are doing this part of the work, they are out generating revenue by getting people in lease. And that amount of work and effort over the last 6 years has been their primary focus. We have not, unless there's been a dispute, gone back to our lessees and said, are you doing everything you told us you were going to do under your lease? When there is an issue, we do address it, but it's not a routine part of the job right now.
I've been assuming, Steve, that compliance means the number of people who are using our land who have an agreement with us to use it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deuce, that's partly correct. Basically, it's also to make sure that if we lease to you for a marina, that you are using the property for a marina, and that you're not added a restaurant or done some or ship repair or some other kind of activity that's not required under our lease or allowed. Also to make sure that lessees stay within their lease boundaries and to make sure that they're not using more area than they're paying us for. There's just a number of compliance issues that come up from time to time that we feel we need to do a better job of. It's not just getting the people under lease, it's also maintaining the service and the leases that we have.
So
that's the part that we're trying to increase.
If 75% is our goal, where are we today?
I would say we're about 50-60%. We've got some new, and we require all of our state lessees to be in compliance with all local, state, and federal laws. And there's a new electrical code, for example, in the city of Portland that's now put 4 of our lessees out of compliance. And we're going to be meeting next week with the chief electrical inspector for the state to try to work out how we're going to get our lessees back into compliance for something that they didn't know was coming, nor did we. So that's part of that goal, is to get out and try to get to every one of our leasehold areas and make sure that they're in compliance, at least 75% compliance, because as much as we know. And things like the electrical code, you know, we didn't know that was coming either, so it kind of caught us by surprise.
Considering that all of this brings money into the Common School Fund.
Well, partly able to be increased in revenues
is that
when you find a lessee who is doing something that they have been authorized to do, and it's usually a change in use. They go from a marina use to a marine industrial use or something else, the fees go up. And hopefully we would be able to increase some of the revenue because we find out they're doing something not supposed to be.
How many total staff will this make working on waterway leases?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this request is only to continue the current limited duration position that we have, which really is one of the 4-person team that does this work. But also point out that these same folks do all the easement work, all the communication site lease work, all the other land leasing work. It's not just only waterways.
Representative Morgan.
Help me understand this if you could. I'm looking at the bottom one, which is this one that's up on the screen right here, and it says accomplishments current biennium is part of a 4-person team generated new easements, so I'm assuming there's 57 new easements, 8 new grazing leases, 28 new waterway leases, and 77 new dock registrations that were put in place by this 4-person team over the last biennium. Am I getting this correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morgan, that's correct. That's for this current biennium. Of course, we still have 3 months to go in this biennium, but those are current numbers as of March 1st, I believe.
Okay, and then am I also correct if I assume that three of these people had been there before and one had been added to the team in this current biennium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Representative Morgan, that's correct.
Would it be, I think that what we need to figure out here is what the increase in productivity was by adding one person, which is going to be real difficult to do, I think, by just looking at these numbers. And it may be easier for us to see the increase in productivity if we could compare the work that was done in the previous biennium when there was only three people there compared to what we did in the current biennium. Is that possible or reasonable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we could certainly do that, but I think it would be a misleading number, to be quite honest.
Why is that?
One of the things that we have done in this last biennium is, as we were going through the re-engineering of our water releasing program, we did a fairly extensive water releasing inventory. And in that inventory, we had to identify all structures on our state-owned waterways. I think it was about 4,000. Part of this limitation position also looked at all of those structures that had to be determined. Were they a lease? Were they a dock registration? Were they an easement? Were they exempt somehow under law? And we had to work through that inventory first before we could get out in the field to start demanding leases from some folks. We've also worked quite extensively with Clatsop County up in Senator Dukes' area to get the county to recognize that they had a part to play in the land use approval of those leases, which has not been able to make us move forward. That approval from Clatsop County did not come until this February. I'm sorry. So I think if I could certainly do that, but I think it would be a very misleading number.
So what you're telling us then is that this information that you have up here on the wall it isn't a great increase over what was accomplished. In fact, it may not be any increase at all over what was accomplished in the previous biennium. Is that because there was this inventory that took place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I don't think I made myself clear then. There's a lot of work that has to be done, pre-work, before you go out and demand a lease or an easement from some state individual. That pre-work has been done, and we are now moving toward the leasing part. Certainly, some of those things that you see on that board were actually performed by this position. A lot of the work that leads up to us being able to go get the leases and the easements and all the other things that we do in our land management side is some of the pre-work that is not reflected there. Because there is not a document that says we have completed an action. We have completed a lease. We have completed an easement. We've simply done the pre-work to get ready to do the work that has to be done. And we're in that mode right now, if you will.
Well, how on earth, then, are we supposed to be able to know what we're buying? I'd be happy to help if I could.
You want to try first?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, what you're buying is a commitment that the division made to the waterway owners and operators that we would get all people using the state-owned waterways under lease or some kind of authorization, whether it's a dock registration, easement, or lease. And as part of that commitment and part of the re-engineering of our water release program, we committed to do a complete water release and inventory. And we did that. And we have that on GIS records. And we have worked our way through that record keeping to identify every structure that we know of that exists on the state's waterway that we can determine and what needs to be done to get that, whether it's a lease and easement or what have you. And it's just like any real estate business, real property business. In order to be able to get folks to do what you want them to do, you've got to know what you got on the waterways. And that's what we've done. That's kind of what you're buying is that expertise that has led to that. There are a number of issues up there that simply would have not simply gotten there if we hadn't done some of that pre-work. Dock registration has been a very good example.
So based on having this inventory in place, can you tell us what you would expect this team of four people to accomplish in the next biennium?
One of the things that we put in one of our performance goals, and I'm not sure we've gotten there yet, is we're going to try to get up to 90% of that water releasing inventory work and all the leasing dock registrations complete. A big chunk of that is going to occur in Clatsop County, where we've been working with the county because that's our last area that has not been fully looked at yet. because
you
there's a land use model.
You haven't completed the inventory yet, is what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morton, we completed the inventory. In order to, for us to lease to an individual, they must be in compliance with the local comprehensive plan. In Clatsop County, they are not in compliance, which means they are in trespass, which means they need to leave the state's border. Part of that commitment was we would work with the county to get the county to get in their land use ordinances the right or the fact that they could tell a person on the waterway they have the right under land use law to be there. That allows us to lease. And we've worked with the county quite extensively to get that, not only that part of the inventory correct, but also to help them realize what they needed to do to help us get our job done. And that's part of what some of this position of this work has done.
So then are we in a place where we have basically spent a lot more common school fund money on process rather than on increasing the revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, certainly. There has to be a cost to owning land and managing land, and one of those costs is you must know what's on the ground if you're going to go out and get leases and easements. And that's part of the upfront cost that any land owner or land manager would have, as a particularly as widespread as we are across the state, where we have to know what's going on our lands. And when we get to some of our other packages and I talk about some of the additional trespasses, as I did yesterday, there's a lot of things there we don't know what's going on. So the inventory was part of trying to get that corrected.
Senator Mesley, Representative Morgan, that inventory, though, was done prior to this biennium. And so we had already had that work in place. And so with knowing we had already done that inventory, that's why in the last, why we asked for this waterway lease for this current biennium. If you, another way of looking at it from a business standpoint is that this, our revenues are up by $700,000, which means that for the cost of this position, we're returning about $4 to $5 for every dollar we've invested in this position. For the common
That's
school
the
fund.
Part that I'm not seeing. I'm not seeing how the revenues increased. I mean, I'm hearing that there was a lot of work done on inventories, and there's a lot of work done on making sure that people complied with the regulations that needed to be complied with.
Well, in the 01, in from 99 to 01, from July 99 to February of 01, our total revenues were about $2.5 million. For the same period for this biennium, they're $3.3 million for what this team works on. So they've brought in more money as a result of having an extra person on the team working through getting these easements and leases and registrations in place. If you look under tab 3 on page 22, you'll see in more detail the accomplishments that that position had during the current biennium as part of that team.
Okay, let's go to Representative Johnson and then Senator Gooch.
I'll defer to Senator Gooch.
I suspected the vast majority of these waterway leases are in my district.
Don't bet on it.
Well,
you probably got you more than your share.
I start in Multnomah County and work my way down river, and then I turn left and go down the ocean. I became interested in this years ago when one day I had a woman talking to me who said she had a home in the Columbia River. Right on the edge. We've got a lot of old buildings, places they used to store grain, places they used to store nets, you name it. They were old warehouses, and people are slowly converting them into homes. So she had this home in the Columbia River, and she was paying $500 a year lease to the state of Oregon. And the people next to her didn't pay a dime. And she resented that, and she didn't understand it. So I don't know who I went to. It may even have been Steve back then and said, so what's going on? And he then carefully explained to me that we didn't know what all was sitting on our land, that he didn't have the staff to be able to inventory and find out who they were. And as they stumbled across them in the course of doing business, then they talk the people into a lease and let them know that they had to. And I started thinking about this. This land all belongs to the state of Oregon. We claim it. And we've got squatters all over the place. Some of them know they're squatting. Some of them don't know they're squatting. And it irritated me because I had no answer for this woman. And I thought, in a way, we don't have any right to charge the one person $500 if we're not going to charge the neighbor anything. So then several years later, Steve and I got to interact over an owner who had a lease with us, but was one of these folks who was now doing more things than and using up more space than the lease had accommodated, and he'd run afoul of his neighbors, and it was more complex than I could handle. So we went out there and we sat down with the owner and talked through the whole thing, and I don't know how much time the division spent on that. They ended up with a legitimate lease. They showed him the easiest and the cheapest way for him to do it in accordance with the business that he wanted to operate, as opposed to, you know, what he thought he was doing, managed to help the fisheries, because that was what they were butting up against. And everybody came away a winner, except then he ended up going out of business and leaving. But, I mean, it was not because of the Division of State Lands, because of a bunch of other things. But I was really impressed with how they handled it, and also impressed with how much time it took to walk through all of the options multiple times, because nobody seemed to get it. They don't seem to want to accept the fact that they don't need to lease half the Columbia River in order to do their operation. They can lease less and still be okay. And so Steve and I have had the misfortune of going through a number of these together. He keeps getting stuck with me and my dumb questions. But so Xander Ferrioli and I got the two limited duration positions in last time for rangeland and waterway leasing. And since then, I followed Larry Potter through the process of trying to get the folks on the John Day. We have a John Day River. We have the other end of the John Day River, and we've got a bunch of houseboats on there. Not bunches in Portland kind of bunch, but for our little community, it's a bunch. And we know that they're there, and we acknowledge them in our land use plan, but the county doesn't have an ordinance saying that they can be there, so that makes them illegal. Nobody considers them illegal, but the agency can't move forward, and the county sure as heck hasn't been moving forward. And then you have to deal with DEQ, because they're all sitting on water, so they have to have some type of a way of discharging whatever they accumulate and need to discharge. And then, by the way, I've got a whole bunch of duck shacks out in the Columbia River. And
you got problems.
I can tell you about duck shacks. They're not all created equal. There's different kinds of duck shacks. So can Representative Johnson tell you about duck shacks? More than she probably ever wanted to know. And the division first had to find out where the heck all these duck shacks were to start out with. Downspouts were pretty easy. They line up in a row. Duck shacks were not so easy. I didn't know Ann houseboats in Blind Slough. I don't know what they're doing in Blind Slough, but they're there, and which is down in Brownsmead. So they've managed to go out and find all of these places, and it's taken a few years, and they've held multiple meetings with them, because you imagine telling somebody who inherited their duck shack from Grandpa that now they're going to have to register. I've been at those hearings. They weren't pretty. Steve's been there. John's been there. They worked it all out. I believe that we now have an ordinance. The county, I think, finally adopted their ordinance, and we're pushing DEQ as best we can to get into some type of facilities, you know, some criteria that these folks can use. And these people are all going to be paying money into the Common School Fund. Many of them are now. I mean, you know the numbers far better than I do, but I would dispute that these folks haven't paid for themselves already. Because we've got people paying money, the appropriate amount of money, to the state of Oregon, because they're living on our land in one way or another. And it's just, I've watched this increase of one position for waterway leasing over the last year, and I've been really glad we had it. And I think that over the long term, we're going to make quite a bit of money off of this.
The thing I worry about, Senator, is that in some cases, if we're not forcing people off, they might not be getting the revenue now, but if we force them off of the land at all, and I'm not saying they
haven't lost a duck shack.
Well, but there's a lot of other users of the state's waters, and I just think we need to be very sensitive, particularly in the economic times we have right now.
Well, I would say in their defense that I have never seen an agency work as hard
to try to resolve issues as they do. Some of these people are not real easy to work with. Some of these public hearings, folks are really angry when they come in, but they come back again and again and again, the agency does, to try to resolve it. And I've been really impressed with it.
Let me ask, and then we need to move along, because we have quite a ways to go in the next 50 minutes. What have you got in your budget for the historical filled wetlands, the cloud zone properties? How many staff do you have working on that now, and what do you anticipate?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we set this budget up, all of our property people do a variety of things. Water releasing, easements, historical fill lands, new lands, communication site, anything that comes up on our lands, these folks do. When we deal with historical fill lands, it's only when an open owner comes to us and says, we believe we have a cloud on our title and we would like to have it cleared up. That's when we work on it. So we did not specifically set a percent of their time to work on that issue. It's just simply something we deal with. As we deal with an easement, when an easement request comes in that we didn't know was coming in, it comes in the queue, we assign the work, and we work on it.
So these four FT we're talking about here also deal with historical filled wetlands?
As they come through on a case-by-case basis, yes.
And how many have you dealt with in the last year or two, 10 years, whatever?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think I can give you off the top of my head. I have to go back and research that. It hasn't been about 39, probably in the last 10 years. We're working on a couple right now. But I would want to verify those numbers for you.
Representative Johnson.
Is there anything that changes the queuing? Let's say on a historical filled site that there's a business transaction that is going to occur and a title's clouded. Does that resolution just get in the queue and work through, or is there some trigger mechanism in your shop that says we have a business deal hanging on the outcome of us cleaning up our records and they go to the front?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's absolutely right. When an applicant notifies us that there's something going on, it could be a sale of property and they need to transfer a lease. It could be a historical fill lands claim with a sale of property. Those things we always try to bump to the lead, to the front, and try to address those as best we can. And, you know, it's a constant decision about workload and assignments, about where they fit in the priority of things.
My concern is one of the appearance, if not the reality, of inequity in this whole process. I think everybody who has a business transaction believes that they're number one. And how you make the decision to prioritize, given the level of staff that you have, the same instance that Senator Dukes pointed out where one person pays X and the other person pays nothing. And at least from the constituents that I have heard from that have had dealings with your office, I think it's the perception that there are different classes of folks that are treated differently by the agency. And that's worrisome to me. I don't have a solution. I think maybe we'll be instructed as the hearing moves along, but it's something that is of concern. I would want to make sure that the business transaction isn't held up by a historically filled wetlands problem that maybe nobody knew about and you guys need to jump in and resolve quickly. Conversely, somebody's duck shack falls to the bottom of the pile every time with a staff that seems as burdened as this one is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that does happen. Sometimes calls from legislatures also get issues bumped to the forefront, mm-hmm. and other folks just simply have to wait. And, you know, we try to do the best job we can of balancing that workload and needs. But we try real hard not to hold up somebody's land transaction or sale because we can't be responsive. And I know that's of a concern for folks who've been waiting for their activity to occur as well. But, you know, we try to balance that as best we can.
And can we move along?
Sure. The other part of this package includes the range position. And this is a position that's been dedicated to working on our range lands in eastern Oregon. This position has been involved with rangeland improvements, for example, water projects on wells and pipelines and fences. He has met with 70% of our lessees, inspected 60% of the leasehold, while we just won a major lawsuit with the Oregon High Desert Association, we're likely vulnerable on looking at individual leases, and it's very critical that we continue this position so we can continue to have a viable program and viable management of our lands. The next position, The next program option package has to do with the Bend office rent increase. Over the last several years, that rent has been steadily increasing to the point where it's getting beyond what we can absorb within budget. That's for $28,309. The next program option package, and this is a new position, this is for an Eastern Oregon property manager. This person would be focused on doing a variety of different land management activities. For example, the other day we provided you with a list of a number of people who would like to buy or exchange land with the state, and that could be very lucrative in selling isolated parcels that the state has. So we'd like to get going on being able to do that. There are trespass issues. We handed out to you the other day a set of communication sites that we need to bring under lease and to monitor those. We've got to continue to pursue doing our rangeland assessments, working on weeds. There are so many different issues and things that we have yet to address that this position could be involved with, as well as trying to further economic development efforts, such as looking at putting out more leases for valuable agricultural land management, wind energy generation, and probably other things we haven't even yet thought of right now. The next program option package has to do with information systems capacity. We've recently learned within the last week or so that IRMD has given us some suggestions about revising this package. If it's okay with the committee, between now and work session, we'd like to work with Legislative Fiscal Office, Budget and Management, and IRMD on this package to revise it so that we look at what our workstation replacement needs to be, where we are to date in the biennium with our needs, because this was put together long ago. My feeling is we could probably reduce this package when we come back to you for work session. The next package is one that we've had a little bit of discussion on. This is for ODOT funding. It would fund two natural resource specialists, and these positions would be focused on trying to fast-track ODOT projects. We have already negotiated a memorandum of understanding that includes performance measures with ODOT. We want these positions there so that they can make sure we get those projects moved as quickly as possible without adversely affecting service to other applicants. The Emergency Board already approved one position for the current biennium, so this would add one more for the next biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
Could we get somewhere along the line a more complete list of what those folks would be doing?
Let me invite Steve up here, and I can also provide you a copy of the memorandum of understanding that we have with ODOT, if that would be helpful.
I don't mean to take the time now. I know we're short of time. It's just before we act on this, I'd like to see a list of what they're going to do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I'll be happy to provide that along with the interagency agreement and the list of what they consider to be their priority work.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. The next program option package would be to continue as a limited duration position, a position that we have in the current budget, and that is for an unclaimed property auditor as well as one trust property assistant. That auditor generates more than returns money for the Common School Fund. That auditor generates about $20 to $22 for the Common School Fund for every dollar that we've spent on that auditor. They have... They have processed 78,000 records, and that we are having as a goal for them to process another 78,000 in the next biennium. They've also worked on the audit. That would be for the assistant position. The auditor, we would be projecting that they would work on 30 audits again in the next biennium, as well as they are assisting us with other activities such as the safe deposit box inventory and conducting internal desk audits. The state lands building is an asset of the Common School Fund, and we charge.
Let's back up. Did you explain what the trust property assistant does?
I'm going to ask Jeanette Holman to come up here and talk a little bit more about the trust property assistant.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for Finance and Administration. The assistant position is basically someone who handles, it can be one of two jobs that they're doing, either taking in the holder reports that come in from the people who are holding unclaimed property. These reports can be anything from one item to thousands of items, depending on who they are. They can also be involved in inventorying the contents of safe deposit boxes as they come in. The other role that this person could be playing, depending on whether they're a claims person or a holder person, is processing claims for people who submit a claim on the as an owner who we found and claimed property for them and identified them. So that's the kind of thing that person will be doing.
Thank you.
The next program option package is regarding our building. It's now, I believe, over 10 years old, and we need to do some work on the HVAC system and electrical upgrade, and that would be for $175,000. Program option package 106 would be for a new position for one limited duration, unclaimed property administrative specialist, and one limited duration seasonal office specialist. This is to try to fulfill the recommendations of the Secretary of State audit that said that we need to have dual custody, that we've got to reconcile our records, address our issues related to processing of mutual funds when we receive them in. The limited duration seasonal office specialist is to try to handle the workload that comes in and to try to process that as quickly as possible, because the quicker that we can process it, the quicker it goes into the bank that we can earn money off of it. Basically, the bulk of our filings for unclaimed properties come in the fall of the year, in October and November. So this would be a seasonal position that would allow us during those 3 months, four months of the year. I think I've got it. 4 months out of the year to help process those records and deposit the money as quickly as possible. This is a situation. One of the things that the audit report said is that we always need to have two people there when we're inventorying property coming in to be able to count it and to inventory it together. If we have an estate where somebody dies, and this frequently happens, you've got to go out to their house and the property, and you need to have two people together. I mean, they need to be in the same room together as they go through that house so that they can inventory the items, secure it, and then be able to manage the property and sell it.
Is there any possibility that you could have priced doing that on contract?
Senator Mesley, Representative Johnson, we are looking into any way that we might be able to do some of that. I think some of that work, we're looking at contracting the cleaning of those homes, but we do have to initially go in there and be able to determine what we have on the property, because it can range from having valuable things to also having major hazards on the property.
I understand that, but I'm just saying, you're asserting that your people have a special level of expertise that allow them to do that, that a adjunct of a legal firm or a firm doing that kind of work is unable to do?
Senator Messerly, Representative Johnson, we in fact do contract with a law firm helping us with processing of the legal documents, and there are a lot of legal documents and paperwork associated with probating an estate. So, we're looking at the most cost-effective way of doing it, so we wouldn't want to have the attorneys doing a lot of that work because of the cost.
Okay.
I'd like to pick up on that. Could you contract with trust departments and banks?
I wasn't implying an attorney's office, Mr. Chair. I was saying
that's what I mean.
A company that is in the business of doing this.
Yeah. Jeanette, why don't you come on up and talk a little bit, because they've looked at a lot of different alternatives. We're certainly open to trying to look at some ways that we might be able to do that, particularly a lot of times when we've got, you can't count on when you're going to get estates coming in. So go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have considered it to use, I think in some cases it does make sense to contract out. We have to sometimes jump and go with very little notice. I'm not sure, these people who are going are not getting paid very much, and I'm not sure that you could contract out for someone to do it cheaper. And it's, I think part of it is that, you know, we may get a call Monday afternoon and have to be in Medford Tuesday morning to do the inventory because for some reason time is of the essence.
We have used temporary firms,
yes,
for helping us do some of the temporary staffing that we need to do.
Follow up?
Yeah. First, you've raised a whole bunch of issues. When you say temporary firms, I presume they're licensed and bonded and all the rest of that sort of stuff. But the other thing is, how often do these jump in the car and go to Medford occur? Is that the norm or is that the rarity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, they probably occur once every 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay, and the last question or observation is that I'm aware of businesses that do this professionally. Not only do they come in and inventory, they carry all the bonding, they carry appraisers. They're sort of one-stop shopping. And you can't open the Sunday paper that you don't see appraisal firms that have excellent reputations for their honesty, their ability to deliver sort of a one-stop service where you'd get the inventory. They contract with cleaning firms. I'm trying to get a sense from you guys of whether or not you've seriously looked at a different model for providing the service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have not gone to the point of checking prices or doing an RFP, but it is certainly something we're looking at. We just have, frankly, not had the time to do it.
Senator Duke.
Just out of sheer curiosity, who lets you know that someone has died and there's no heirs? I don't understand why the house doesn't just sit there.
With a dead body.
Lower the purchase price. We do, we get calls from the police, we get calls from the coroners, we get calls from general homes. If they're in an apartment complex, we sometimes get calls from the managers. And if it's someone like a mortuary general home, they often have tried to find some kind of information about relatives before they call us. The police will often go in and do a cursory check for relatives, but often that first visit within 5 days is one where we go in and start going through the papers and looking for, you know, sometimes I find these relatives by finding an old birthday card and running down that return address person, and they'll know someone who knew this person or they're related. I mean, that's what that first visit does.
So whoever's responsible for finding someone to deal with the fact that this person has died and can't find anybody calls you. Okay.
Representative Johnson.
I just feel compelled to say this. There are firms that do that. And I mean, I guess that you make it sound sort of mysterious that somebody finds a birthday card and through the birthday card they're able to trace back. And there are professional firms that support bunches of employees doing exactly that in a very methodical, scientific, I presume cost-effective method.
In fact, we, Senator Messerly, Representative Johnson, in fact, we do contract with some of those firms when we have to do airship locations.
Okay, let's move along.
Okay. The next package involves South SLU. Package 103 would continue as limited duration, one natural resource specialist and one public service coordinator. These are funded with federal funds. It would be one individual does habitat monitoring for system-wide monitoring in the reserve, and the other one, a public service coordinator, provides information and related services at the interpretive center. Package 112 would be a position realignment. It would reclassify a natural resource or a position to a natural resource specialist so that it is on par with the other two individuals. There are basically three functions that the South SLU is involved with, stewardship, research, and education. And the research and education individuals that are responsible for that are currently at a natural resource specialist 3 position. This would then have that stewardship coordinator be at the similar position.
And are we out of compliance with NOAA's requirements and outcome measures?
Actually, I'm pleased to report that we're now in compliance with NOAA's audit that had been done on South SLU. We have completed the site profile, which was the main item that had been cited by NOAA this year. So. And with regard to South SLU, I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself. One, a budget note that was in our last budget, ensuring that we tighten up financial controls and management oversight on South SLU. We did that. We are producing financial reports. We have a monthly meeting where Jeanette has been, I think, burning the highways between here and Salem, as well as myself and Cindy Wickham going down there to meet. We have complied with the legislature's requirements strictly with regard to grants. So we have met what had been put forth by the legislature in that budget note, and I think South SLU is much better for it.
And you heard yesterday by Ron Steffens, I guess, that came up from the South SLU, when I acquired the relationship with the gift shop in the Sanctuary's meeting place. And I've had a complaint from one of your past employees of the relationship and the financial relationship. Is there any payment to the sanctuary for the use of that facility? Or I assume that it's manned by volunteers. And are we totally legal in that respect?
Senator Messerly, we are. That is volunteers that staff that shop. In fact, they also help with some of the reception duties for South SLU. One of the things that we did in tightening up management oversight for South SLU was to go in and do an internal audit using one of our internal auditors to look at the procedures of that gift shop and what we needed to do to strengthen the financial relationships between South SLU and the volunteer organization. And we've made those changes, but one of the products of that is legislation that has passed the Senate already that would allow us to have a formal agreement with the volunteer association. So it would help with things such as liability issues, similar to what Parks has with their volunteer groups.
But trying to be more specific, even though they retain the profits from their gift shop, they pay no lease to the sanctuary for the use of the property or the building?
Senator Messerly, no, they don't pay a lease. I think the feeling on the part of the commission is that the in-kind contribution that they make with their volunteers staffing that shop and the fact that
those profits are plowed back into South SLU for improvements or for exhibits is a good in-kind payment that more than makes up for what we would be charging them. And given, as you heard from Ron Steffen yesterday, the Friends of South SLU in the last year and a half have raised over $130,000, maybe upwards of $150,000 now for South SLU that benefited the expansion and the exhibits.
And I'm not certain whether that's right or wrong. I'm just concerned that is it set up in a formal memorandum or a formal contract or any formal structure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Leslie, Mr. Chair. There's not a formal agreement yet. That's something we're working on. I've been working on it with the Friends of South SLU. It's also something that I think we definitely need to have a more formal agreement. Friends of South SLU would love to have a more formal agreement, and in part we're kind of waiting to see if your bills that you introduced on our behalf, Senate Bill 311, if there's things that we can include as a result of that bill that will make it all one stop instead of having to amend it right away. We came very close to having an agreement about a year ago. Well, I guess it wasn't. Yeah, about a year ago. And then when we decided to do the legislation, we haven't done it since then.
And part of the reason I'm concerned is that when I realized yesterday or the day before that half the expenditures of the administration are really common school funds, that could awaken a lot of interest from.
I should note that there was a debate in the legislature, I think it was in the 97 session, about what to do with the South SLU in terms of using the common school fund or having it general fund, and it was general fund. And the legislature did debate that in 97 and decide that it wanted to make it an asset of the common school fund.
A few years ago, there was an audit done of state parks. And I recall that one of the state parks had a relationship with a nonprofit organization. They were allowing them to sell T-shirts, and then the money went back to the nonprofit. It was one of the issues that the Secretary of State's office pointed out in the audit. I don't believe it's going on anymore. I'm guessing that the Friends of South SLU is a nonprofit organization.
Yes.
I'm guessing that when you were deciding to let them sell on your grounds that you didn't offer that up to any other nonprofit organization, that there's been no competitive, you know, a nonprofit A, B, and C could come in and do it as well. All of those things are of great concern to me. It's on the surface, it makes sense. You all want to do the same thing they want to do, and so, you know, and they're helping you do it, and we're getting good out of it. But when it comes to a public entity like the state of Oregon, we're supposed to offer the same opportunities to everyone, and in fact, we're not. So I'd suggest you take a serious look at all of that, and maybe you can go back and have a look at the state parks audit a few years ago.
That's a good point. I have not looked at the state parks audit.
We'll do that.
We've got, I think you have 7 more slides, and so we got 3 minutes.
I will try to go through them quickly.
That's our fault, not yours.
POP 108 deals with fire suppression and rehabilitation. This is for $150,000. As I mentioned, for the first time, we do have a fire contract with BLM. This would be to reimburse BLM for actual expenses. In the 0103 biennium, the costs of fire suppression and rehabilitation were $230,000. So we tried to have a conservative amount in there for this request, and it just depends each year on what the fire season is.
And we're expecting a worse fire season than last year, is that? And yet you've reduced the amount, is that right?
Well, we wanted to come in with a conservative amount. If it ends up being larger than that, then we would come into the emergency board and ask for expenditure authority to go higher. Right now what we do is whenever we have a fire, we have to come in each time for the emergency board. This helps greatly in our agreement with the BLM. Okay. Talking about budget notes in what was done, one of the budget notes dealt with permanent financing to fund reclassifications of the director and assistant director. DAS did review that and approve the reclasses, and we use the permanent financing mechanism to do this. We've talked to you already about the performance of waterway leasing and range positions, and that's also outlined in Roman numeral 4B1 in your packet on essential packages. Another program budget note was on the state programmatic general permit. We have had numerous discussions with interested parties as well as presentations to legislative committees on this. I already mentioned what we had done on South Slough. We did report quarterly. We have and we did complete the construction project, I'd say very close to being on time and within the budget we had projected for that, and we have obtained legislative review of federal grant applications and sought your approval anytime we either applied or sought to accept the grant. Another budget note had to do with transferring the Natural Heritage Program operations to OSU. That was done and completed in an agreement as of June of 2002, and the database was also transferred to OSU. Regarding financial audits, there was a Secretary of State audit for trust property that we requested, and we mentioned that earlier this week in our presentations. I want to mention that we do have a supplemental request that was not part of the governor's recommended budget, although we do have the approval from the governor's office and from budget and management on this. At the time that we put together our budget regarding South Slough, it was still unclear about what federal funding levels would be. So what we're asking for this supplemental request is to allow us to continue four limited duration positions that are at the South Slough at this time into the next biennium. We would be asking for position authority only because funding is included in our grants and limitations within the governor's balanced budget. So with that, our one presentation.
Okay. Thanks, sir. Previous to your public hearings, I've requested information from the department. I think the only thing that we're lacking is the cost of legal. And is that, where are we with that?
The cost of, I'm sorry.
Jeanette Holman, for the...
Mr. Chair, I'm anticipating you're talking about the navigability issues. We've gone through the past 2001, 2002 legal billings from DOJ, and the cost for navigability issues has been about $177,000 over that three-year period. That includes some legal costs that remain from the Chetco trial, some the cost of the Sandy River navigability study, the cost of the John Day trial tried twice, and all the other miscellaneous. What we did is look for anything that had to do with navigability or floatage easement, or, you know, in their captions for giving us advice as best we could tell.
Could you get that to the committee?
I sure can. In writing? Absolutely.
Any questions before we hear from Lisa? Lisa Pearson.
While Lisa's passing that out, I did want to provide for the committee that they can look at. There have been a number of questions about what programs of the Division of State Lands might go to other agencies. I wanted to point out to you that there had been a study that was done at the request of the legislature that the DAS did, looking at our various programs and deciding whether or not they were most appropriate to be within the Division of State Lands or elsewhere. So you can look at this too.
Lisa Pearson of the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll be working from this document that was just handed out. And Mr. Chair, a big deal of this document deals with policy packages that we just went over, so if it's okay with the committee, I would just summarize those briefly at the end and not go through them individually. As sort of a reminder of where we've been this week, if you return to page 2, this table summarizes the historical expenditures, and in that last, well, the third column from the right, you'll find the governor's balanced budget figures. And the important thing to remember here is that this was developed last fall. So first, to begin with, we have a 21 or 22% decrease in total funds from the fifth special session, and 77% decrease in general funds because of the movement of the natural heritage database to OSU. There's an 8.5% increase in other funds because of the anticipation of the fee revenue from the bill for removal bill permits, fee increase. And there's a 34, almost 35% increase in the federal funds, primarily because of, decrease. Primarily because of construction limitation that was used during this current biennium. And then there's a nearly 30% reduction in other funds non-limited, and that's the net effect of the elimination of a one-time distribution that was additional in the third special session from the Common School Fund to schools, and that was about $17.7 to $18 million. And that's partially offset with the forecast will be developed again last fall. And overall, if you take that $17.7 million out, you gain about $3 million in the Common School Fund distribution from the 2001-03 period to the 2003-05 period. Unfortunately, some recent statistics suggest that that may need to be looked at again, including the data on the forest revenue that we heard later or earlier in the week, where it went down from $26.6 million to $20.9 million in revenues for the Common School Fund. Turning to page 3, this chart shows the breakdown of the other funds or the funding types. Other funds in this agency, both the other fund non-limited and the other funds limited, are from the Common School Fund. There's a small amount of general fund, which is in support of the Natural Heritage Advisory Council, and that's all services and supplies. And then there are federal funds primarily for the South SLU. And those primarily come from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Slide 4, or page 4, again summarizes what happened between the fifth special session and the governor's balanced budget. And again, we mentioned that there was this distribution or additional distribution of the $17.7 million in Common School Fund. Major programs that are included include the waterway leases, rangeland management, unclaimed property management, and Department of Transportation projects. And we just heard the policy packages that go with those programs. Turning to page 5, this pie chart shows the major programs and what proportion of the total agency budget they are representing. Common School Fund is 94% of the agency's budget, and so obviously primarily most activity occurs there, not just the Common School Fund distribution, but activities that we've been discussing in efforts to increase revenues to the Common School Fund, and a great deal of policy packages is for the South SLU program you heard about, that's about 4% of the budget. The Oregon Wetlands Revolving Fund is about 1% of the budget. Capital improvements is about 1%. And the National Heritage Advisory Council is less than 1%. And that's that general fund that I mentioned earlier. Moving to page 6. This pie chart shows the major categories of expenditures. And special payments with the Common School Fund payment or distribution make up the majority of the expenditures in this agency's budget. That's followed by personal services at 21%. That's about $11 million total funds. Then after that is the services and supplies budget, and that's where the general fund is for the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. And then there's a small amount for capital outlay.
Turning to page 7, this slide describes how the governor's budget was developed, starting with the legislatively adopted budget. There were two emergency board actions that occurred through April 2002. They both dealt with the South SLU and do have some repercussions for policy packages that were discussed just a moment ago in terms of wanting to continue some positions. Then going on to base budget adjustments, there was the elimination of the one-time $17.7 million common school fund distribution. And again, the common school fund distribution is about $3 million up once you take that out from the 2001-03 distribution budgeted in the 2001 budget. Just to let you know, the 2003-04 distribution from the common school fund is estimated to be at the minimum 2% under distribution policies, because unfortunately it looks like there's going to be about a 10% decline from the 2001 December fund balance to the December 2002 fund balance, and that's what's used to predict how much will be distributed in 2003-04. And then the amount that's distributed in 2004-05 is estimated to go up, but that may be overly optimistic at this point. That was developed using the Frank Russell Company's estimate in general terms of what the stock market was going to do, and that was about a 7.25% increase, and right now it's not looking that good, so that may need to be revisited. Moving on to page 8. The highlight on that page would be the multiple phase-outs of many different issues, many of which, again, come back as requests for positions as limited durations in policy packages that we just heard about. The other thing to note here is that this agency, like all natural resource agencies, has not had the inflation piece taken out yet like the other major general fund policy areas did in the seventh balanced budget, but that's expected to happen for work session. And as we mentioned before, the personal services costs still, you know, at this point include the merits, but those are going to come out as well, and we're working on those with LFO to pull those out. That takes us to page 9. Package 081 was the third special session, and that was the salary range 38 and above salary adjustment. There was one salary affected in this agency. And then the 091 package is the special session 5 reductions, and that turned out to be about $1,000 off of the $33,000 that was in the agency's budget general fund for the Natural Heritage Advisory Commission Council. And then the remainder are the policy packages you just heard about. And just to summarize those, about half of them are continuations of positions that exist in the current biennium but are limited duration and so will automatically go away at the end of this biennium. That half of the position actions or requests are, in fact, requested as limited duration again in the 2003-05 biennium budget. Then the other half are new positions, and those are permanent, and we've frankly gone into a great deal of detail, so I won't go into any more on those. Some of them are permanent.
Yeah, some of them, yes.
And that leads us to page 12, which includes the fee or revenue changes, Senate Bill 2263 with restricted renewal bill permit fees. It was mentioned earlier that the fee was last changed in 1989, that the fee now covers less than 15% of the permitting costs, and that this would generate an estimated approximately $400,000 in revenue in addition to what they already draw in. And that basically summarizes what you've heard for the past few days. If there are any questions, I think, would be happy to try and answer them in the time remaining.
Any questions? Lisa? Any further questions to Ben? Thank you very much.
A couple of items I just wanted to pass out to you before we adjourn the meeting. One is
in response to Representative Morgan's request for some information on revenue and expenditures from the Department of Forestry, and I'm told that these numbers could change in a minor way. We're still working on these, but the Department of Forestry wanted to get these to you. These are the ones that pertain to the common school fund issue that we talked about the other day. And then the other one is just the agenda for next week, or the schedule for next week, and that is the Department of Forestry's budget that you'll be hearing all week.
Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing and we'll close the committee.